What sort of solution? Meguiar asked intently. Well, a lot will depend on trying it out experimentally, but the bore pressure's going to peak heavily at the moment the powder charge detonates, then drop rapidly as the shell moves up the barrel. That means the greatest pressures will be at the breech, where they've always been, but even higher. What we've done with the current guns is simply to increase the thickness of the barrel walls, but that would be self-defeating in terms of weight and mobility if pressures go as high as I'm afraid they will. For that matter, the thicker a barrel wall gets, the more proportionately brittle it becomes. Given that, our thought is that we might cast and rifle the iron barrel using the techniques we've largely perfected for the smoothbore guns, then fit a band of wrought iron around the breech. If we heat the band red-hot to expand it, then force it over the breech and cool it with a spray of cold water, it will effectively weld itself to the gun as the hot metal shrinks. That would reinforce the most vulnerable portion of the gun with the more flexible strength of the wrought iron. It'll still be more expensive, and take more time than to simply rely on cast iron by itself. Yes, Your Grace, it will. Quite a bit, in fact, although it would cost far less than to try producing the entire gun out of wrought iron, which would be our other option. But iron guns strong enough to fire rifled shells to the ranges we clearly need would be massive, very heavy weapons, far heavier than our current field guns. If the bandit approach works, the pieces would be much lighter, not as light as our present guns, but far, far lighter than if they were made solely out of iron. I see. Meguiar inhaled deeply. In that case, by all means, proceed with your experiments as quickly as possible. Of course, Your Grace. Fulton made a note on his pad and flipped to the next page. He gazed at his own handwriting for a moment, then cleared his throat. And that, Your Grace, brings us to the heretic's priming caps, I'm afraid. Meguiar smiled thinly at the other man's suddenly more tentative tone. Production circles, shell design, banded artillery, none of those things required any innovations treading too closely upon the prescriptions. The heretic's priming caps were another matter. Yes, he responded as encouragingly as he could. I believe Lieutenant Zweger's correct about that, too, Fulton said. My examination of the caps Bishop Militant Carnier captured on the dive-in confirms that the heretics are using fulminated mercury. What they appear to have done is form the cap, insert a bit of fulminated mercury into the cup, then seal it with a simple varnish. I'm not a Pasqualite or a Schulerite, so I can't say whether or not this constitutes an actual violation of Pasquale's law or the prescriptions, but I imagine it must at least press closely on Pasquale's law, Your Grace. Its tactical advantages are obvious, but without a special dispensation... I see. Meguiar leaned back in his chair as Fulton let his voice trail off. He'd been afraid he was going to hear exactly that. There are some countervailing considerations, Your Grace, Fulton continued after a moment. For one thing, I don't have any reliable estimates for the man-hours involved in producing them. And, of course, a rifle fitted to use them couldn't be primed with loose powder if the supply of caps ran out. Meguiar nodded, although he strongly suspected Fulton was presenting arguments which would take the onus for pushing the introduction of similar caps off his shoulders. Making it clear, he'd considered the arguments against just as carefully as he had the arguments for, and that, as a dutiful son of Mother Church, he would defer to the final judgment of his ecclesiastic superiors. Well, you knew he was a smart fellow, Elaine, didn't you? We need to find out how to make them and determine what would be required to produce them in quantity, he said after a moment. The apparent increase in reliability is simply too great for us not to at least consider acquiring. At the same time, I suspect the Grand Inquisitor may be hesitant about extending any dispensations in this regard beyond the manufactories under Mother Church's direct control. Assuming he's willing to grant one even there, of course, he thought, meeting Fulton's eyes levelly, until the other man nodded ever so slightly. So I think what we need to consider is modifying this new breech-loading design to use primer caps and building it here and in the other Temple Lands manufactories. Assuming the Inquisition determines that the new caps don't violate the prescriptions, or that a general dispensation can be granted in view of the necessities of the Jihad, I'd like to convert all our rifles to that system in the fullness of time. For right now, it seems to me, we ought to concentrate on producing enough breech loaders to equip a company or two in each infantry regiment. That would provide our divisional commanders with a force capable of skirmishing toe-to-toe with the heretics, backed up by the conventional muzzle loaders. Of course, Your Grace, Fulton agreed, and Maguire nodded yet again. I know how much Jaspar hates granting dispensations that weren't his idea to begin with, he reflected grimly. But if he wants to win this jihad, and survive, he'd damn well better find it in his heart to let Lincoln and me give our men the weapons they need to survive.
Well, that's irritating, Narman Bates murmured balefully. The portly little prince sat in the electronic analog of his Eraster Palace library, rather than on his balcony, and his expression was less than delighted. St. Kilmon's was far enough from the temple itself for the snarks to observe with impunity, and he'd been keeping an eye on Brother Lincoln for quite some time. He'd realized long ago that Fulton had a dangerously capable brain. Back in the days when he'd been an independent prince involved in the great game, the decision to have him and his assistant, Briers, assassinated would have made itself. But like Lieutenant Jouéguer and Dolar, they were doing exactly what Nemu Alban needed them to do. Merlin Athrawas's priorities might have become a bit more complicated, but there wasn't much question about Nemu's, and from her perspective, Fulton, Briers, and Jouéguer were pearls beyond price. They were stretching their minds, learning to think critically and innovatively, and pushing the envelope of allowable technology. And the very qualities which made them so dangerous to the Empire of Karras also made them weapons which must ultimately turn in Jaspar Clinton's hand. I could wish they were just a little less capable while they were about it, though, Narman thought dourly. For that matter, I wish Duquesne were a little less capable. If he and Maguire get away with it, and I think they will, they're actually going to turn the Hardchungese army into an effective fighting force, and that's the last thing we need, aside from this damn thing anyway. He scowled at the neat technical drawing Owl had provided. It really was an ingenious design, he thought, one that virtually duplicated what had once been called a Ferguson rifle back on old Earth. Actually, Jouéguer's design, especially as modified by Fulton, was superior to Ferguson's in some ways. It was heavier and longer, but it also avoided the weakness in the wrist of the stock, which had been part of Ferguson's original design, and the longer barrel and conical bullet would improve its ballistics. The breech screw was a multi-start thread design, like Ferguson's, but with 10 threads per inch instead of Ferguson's 12, and Fulton's decision to make it from brass instead of iron or steel would make good use of the bronze smelting capacity, which would be useless for the production of rifled artillery. And Fulton had put his finger unerringly on an advantage Ferguson hadn't had. When the British officer had developed his weapon, the breech plug's design, essential to the rifle's effectiveness, had precluded any chance of putting it into general service, despite its enormous tactical advantages. The combined gunsmiths of 18th-century England would have been hard put to manufacture as many as 1,000 multi-start screws to acceptable tolerances in an entire year, which made it impossible to build the weapon in sufficient numbers. Safehold, unfortunately, had certain advantages England had lacked. It couldn't produce the screws to standardized dimensions in widely separated locations, but with the addition of a few specialists in plumbing to Briers's circles, they could produce them in much higher numbers than Jouéguer had estimated. No single manufactory's screws would be interchangeable with any others, but that was already true for the parts of their muzzle-loading rifles. The manufacture of the screws would drive up expense, but Narman and Owl had even better figures on the church's production numbers than the church did, and even Fulton's man-hour estimates were overly pessimistic.
If he had to be this inventive, why couldn't he at least have gone with a single-start screw? Norman groused. Surely he could have justified it on the basis that it would be simpler and cheaper to manufacture. And it would also have required 10 complete revolutions to disengage a plug with uninterrupted threads. The multi-start screw required only a single partial turn of the trigger guard to which it was attached, which would speed the rate of fire considerably. And the breaks in the threads would actually help clear them of fouling. The built-up powder would be scraped off and fall through the openings each time the plug was locked up to fire. Without that, the fouling from the black powder would quickly varnish the screw to an extent which would make it difficult or even impossible to operate without a thorough cleaning. It remained to be seen how well the weapon would work in action, but according to Owl's research, the original Ferguson had been capable of 6 to 10 aimed shots per minute, with a flintlock. It had also been capable of up to 60 shots between cleanings, which compared favorably with any existing Safeholdian muzzle loader. If Clinton was willing to allow the Army of God to use primer caps, it ought to be able to reach the higher end of that rate of fire. And, of course, since the innovative bastard had specified a top-opening breech, it would be almost as easy to load from a prone position as a Mondrain. The more he thought about it, the more attractive Assassin seemed, but he pushed the temptation firmly aside. It was what they needed if they truly meant to break the prescription's grip on Safehold after all. Besides, the pains in the arse have already spread drawings all over the damned Temple Lands. We'd need an army of assassins to deal with everyone who's seen it, and I doubt even Iva has that many available. He sighed and shook his head, then grinned suddenly. It's not really funny, I guess, but it's comforting to know even Merlin can make mistakes. He and Edward were so pleased when Mondrain came up with a design that would be just outside the mainland's capabilities. One, it would take them at least a year and a half to put into production, because first they'd have to develop the machine tools and processes. Now the clever little protege he wouldn't let me assassinate's come up with a design that's at least as effective, and they can start producing the damn thing inside a month. He sat back and tossed the technical drawing onto the tabletop with a chuckle. It was almost worth finding out what Jouéguer and Fulton had come up with, if only because of how he was looking forward to Merlin's expression when he and Owl told him about it. Chapter 5. Outside Thesmar, the Southmarch Lands, Republic of Siddermark. Well, it only took 3 5-days longer than it should have, Sir Reynos Alvarez growled. He made it a habit to be careful about the audience to whom he displayed his disgust. At the moment, that audience consisted solely of Captain Latimer and Colonel McIntyre, however. He trusted their discretion. Besides, they were probably even more disgusted with their allies than he was. No, he told himself. They can't possibly be more disgusted with those assholes than I am. They're probably as disgusted, though. That might not be the best attitude for an army commander marching off to war shoulder to shoulder with his allies in the sacred cause of Mother Church and God himself. It was, unfortunately, the one with which he was stuck. 3 5-days might be a little severe, sir. McIntyre frowned judiciously. I don't think it took them much more than 2 5-days more than it would have taken us from the time the order was given. Probably not, Alvarez growled back. But the bastard ought to have given the order at least 1 damned 5-day earlier than he did, instead of getting almost 6,000 men killed or wounded for nothing. Now there, sir, you have a point. The artillerist, whose relationship with his own general had improved considerably since the assault, acknowledged. The three of them sat their horses on the crest of a low hill, watching the enormous column get underway. Solid regiments of Desnarian cavalry led the way, of course. How could it have been otherwise? Certainly no reasonable person would suggest Dalaran cavalry might be as well suited to that duty. The very thought was preposterous. And, equally of course, It only made sense to keep the components of each portion of the Army of Shiloh brigaded together, given the differences in their supply systems and organization. It was purely a coincidence that that happened to put virtually all of what had been the Army of Justice on the road in front of Alvarez's troops. Just as it was purely coincidental that Harless had chosen Sir Foster Richter to command the detachment being left behind to keep Thesmar invested. The Desnarian Duke had been careful to allude to Richter's greater experience against the heretics, but there was no doubt in Alvarez's mind, or of the rest of his army for that matter, that the Duke's real reasoning was somewhat different. Obviously, anyone who'd allowed himself to be besieged by an inferior force was sadly lacking in aggressiveness and determination. Best to leave him behind where he could sit in the sort of fortified position he apparently preferred. Apparently not even the casualties he'd taken trying to storm a fortified heretic position were enough to change Harless's opinion in that regard. Well, at least Harless's prejudices mean we've got somebody competent covering the canal-headed Trevir, Alvarez reflected grimly. That means our supply line back to Dalar should be intact, and that we get an extra day in camp while we wait for him to get the Shanwei out of our way. I wish to Chihiro we were leading the march, sir. Captain Latimer kept his voice low, as if he were afraid they might be overheard even on their isolated hilltop. Come now, Lincoln, McIntyre said. Surely you must acknowledge that the sheer striking power and splendid martial ardor of our vanguard must sweep all opposition aside. Alvarez's lips twitched, although he knew he should step on his subordinates' scorn for their allies. Fortunately, both McIntyre and Latimer were smart enough not to show it, openly at least, in front of anyone else. Actually, sir, I wasn't thinking in terms of combat power, Latimer replied. I was thinking in terms of speed. McIntyre's sardonic expression turned sober, and Alvarez nodded. I was thinking the same thing. Their quartermasters ought to be shot, assuming the court-martial didn't decide on something more lingering. He grimaced. For an army so in love with cavalry, they seem awfully short on wagons and draft animals. That's because they are, McIntyre shrugged disgustedly. To be honest, I think they expected all along to forage on the countryside, whatever they may say now. Mind you, I would have thought the reports about what was happening in the Republic might have suggested even to them that forage would be hard to come by. That's what they suggested to us, anyway. On the other hand, they did start later than we did, and the South March climate means there should be grass, at least, pretty much year-round. And to be fair, much as the thought of being fair pains me just at the moment, you understand, they've got a lot more cavalry than we do, and horses eat a lot. They would have needed a lot more wagons to haul enough fodder. Then they should have brought them, Alvarez said flatly. I think Duke Harless has begun to figure that out, sir. Latimer managed, Alvarez noted, to leave out the word even immediately before Harless's title, and he hadn't tacked at last onto the end either, but his audience heard both of them anyway. Sir Boris certainly has, at any rate. According to Lieutenant Casimar, there's not a lot he can do about it at this point, though. Alvarez looked at the captain and raised one eyebrow. Sir Lyman Casimar, the youngest son of the Duke of Sharak, was assigned to the staff of Sir Boris Kostner, the Army of Justice's quartermaster. In fact, as nearly as Alvarez could determine, Casimar was Kostner's staff. Although the youngster, he was only in his middle 20s, seemed both energetic and intelligent, he was rather in the position of a man trying to bail out Gorath Bay with a teaspoon. Kostner was over 70, and owed his position to the fact that he was the brother of the Duke of Shirkal, who'd been prevented from lending his own talents to the Army of Justice because he was even older than Sir Boris. Kostner seemed a decent enough type who took his duties seriously. Unfortunately, he clearly had very little idea of how to discharge those duties. The size, or absence, of his staff and the appointment of someone as manifestly unequal to the task as he was himself only underscored the Desnarian's casual attitude toward the task of keeping an army in the field supplied. Logistic incompetence had contributed more than a little to how roughly the Sidermarkian army had handled them in the past, and it was a pity they hadn't taken that lesson to heart. What made it even more infuriating was that Mother Church had taken over responsibility for moving supplies in the Desnarians' rear areas. Traffic moved almost as smoothly and efficiently along the canals and high roads from Desnair to the army of Shiloh's position before Thesmar as it did from Dolar. And that, unfortunately, simply meant that a veritable mountain of Desnarian supplies was accumulating at that point, since the Duke of Trakos had graciously declined Vicar Robert's offer to assist the Imperial Desnarian army's efforts to keep itself fed in the field. Why he'd done that was more than Sir Reynos Alvarez could divine, although he was willing to grant the possibility that Trakos actually believed the Army of Justice was equal to the task. He couldn't imagine what might have convinced Trakos of that, however.
Be fair. Their supply arrangements could still be worse. Just think about the Harchongians. For that matter, our Quartermaster Corps was a disaster waiting to happen before we reorganized it, and you damned well know it. Just like you know you're damned lucky you have Templar himself running it for you. Especially after you tried so hard to avoid him.
He frowned. That wasn't one of his happier memories, but it was one he made himself reflect upon every so often, just as he made himself revisit his original attitude towards MacIntyre. Sir Shulman Rogers, the Baron of Templar, had been intimately involved in building up the pre-Jihad Navy as part of King Ronild's effort to control the Gulf of Dolar. In fact, he'd been both knighted and raised to the nobility for his services to the crown and to the navy. He was able, unusually honest, and a fervent son of Mother Church, and those three qualities explained why the Duke of Fern had chosen him to organize the army's supply system in cooperation with Vicar Robert's advisors. The fact that he'd worked so closely and enthusiastically with Earl Thirsk in his efforts to rebuild the navy, and that he and Thirsk were close friends, explained why Alvarez had tried to decline his services. He'd done a remarkably good job, and when the army had been ordered into the field, he'd volunteered, successfully, despite Alvarez's quiet opposition, to command the quartermasters he'd trained. The fact that he'd been made a general, with two full colonels as his immediate subordinates, said volumes about the differences between Desnarian and Dolaran attitudes when it came to keeping their men fed and supplied. Alvarez had come to realize, even before uniting with the Army of Justice, that the failure of his effort to decline Templar's services had been one of the more fortunate things ever to happen to him. Since coming under Harless's command and seeing the Desnarian arrangements, he'd spent more than one night in prayerful thanks to the Archangels for proving how much wiser than him they were.
"And just what did young Kazimar have to say about it?" he asked Latimer after a moment.
"Well, he didn't want to be openly critical of Duke Harless or Sir Boris, of course, sir, but from the questions he was asking, what he'd really like would be to overhaul their existing arrangements into something more like ours. There aren't enough dragons or wagons for them to do that, though, and even if there were, they don't have the drovers or the organizational structure to support it. From a couple of the things he said, and even more from the things he didn't say, to be honest, Sir Boris is already tearing his hair out over the situation, and he's given Lieutenant Kazimar, a lot of extra authority to try to straighten out the situation."
"Authority?" MacIntyre snorted. "How much authority can a lieutenant have, Lincoln?"
"A bit less than a captain, sir," Latimer replied with a smile, and Alvarez chuckled. "Seriously," his aide went on, smile fading, "I happened to overhear him ripping a strip off a colonel day before yesterday."
"A colonel?"
MacIntyre repeated, eyebrows rising.
"Yes, sir, one of Earl Hennett's regimental commanders."
The captain shrugged. "Lyman chewed him up one side and down the other, respectfully, of course, over something to do with transporting the officer's personal baggage in the quartermaster's wagons. I don't think he was in favor of the idea."
His superiors laughed, despite themselves, and Latimer shrugged.
"What may be even more important, the colonel took it, Sir Reynos,
and I doubt he would have if he hadn't expected Hennet or Harless to support Lyman if he pushed it. That's one of the reasons I think they're genuinely doing their best. It's just that the hole's so deep they can barely see daylight looking straight up at midday. Alvarez found it remarkably easy to stop laughing as he contemplated the accuracy of his aide's last comment. Where the Royal Dalaran Army assigned individual dragon-drawn wagons to each of its regiments, the Imperial Desnarian Army relied upon a centralized transport pool. Each Dalaran regiment's wagon moved with its regiment, whether on the road or in the field. As it was depleted, it returned to the main transport column moving down the canals or along the roads behind the rest of the army. If there was time, it was reloaded and sent back to rejoin its assigned regiment. If there was insufficient time for that, its drovers simply exchanged it for a fully loaded wagon and hurried back. The size and weight of the articulated wagon a dragon could draw, 20 or 30 tons in anything like reasonable going, allowed the army to move smoothly, confident its supplies would keep up with it. That wasn't to say that even a Dalaran army moved at anything much above a walk once it was forced to abandon the speed and efficiency of the canals, but it did move at a steady walk with a 10-minute rest stop each hour. And if a unit was forced to halt for some reason, it simply moved off the road to be bypassed by the rest of the army without anyone finding himself suddenly out of supply and starving. The Desnarians had nowhere near that flexibility. They had sufficient carrying capacity for their army's ammunition and food, but there was no way they could possibly transport sufficient fodder for over 100,000 cavalry mounts, half that many again remounts, meat animals, and their draft animals. They simply didn't have enough wagons for that, and the ones they did have formed a column of their own, moving at the rear of their entire vast force. The cavalry could at least find grass to graze their horses, and the quartermaster could graze the accompanying cattle, and it was late enough in the year that any volunteer crops which had sprung up untended by the vanished farmers at the scores of abandoned farms could be scooped up as well. Assuming they hadn't yet rotted in the fields, at least. That meant they probably could forage for the fodder and grazing they required, but sending out foraging parties and stopping to graze could only slow their rate of advance. And then there was the problem that the South March lands had been so sparsely populated. It was over 800 miles from Thesmar to Fort Terrace, their objective, the last 200 on little better than country lanes and farm tracks. The high road, built to the Ritz standards, offered good, hard going as far as the town of Karmic, but without the network of secondary roads found in more populous provinces. That meant the entire army of Shiloh had to move along the same highway like some huge, lurching serpent. Left to its own devices, with its well-organized supply train and wagon loads of fodder, Alvarez's army could have made 50 miles a day along that high road and over 20 miles per day even cross-country. Unfortunately, his army was trapped behind the Duke of Harless's army, which would do extraordinarily well to make 20 miles a day even with the high road, given the need to send out those foraging parties and stop to graze its horses. Its cavalry and infantry regiments alone would have formed a 17-mile column. By the time artillery, supply wagons, remounts, livestock, the inevitable camp followers, and the personal servants required by all those aristocratic officers were added, it was the next best thing to 27, even with the herds of meat animals and remounts spread off the road as much as possible. Which means, given how damned slow we're going to move, that Harless's rearguard units will end up every night 7 miles west of where his vanguard bivouacked the night before. And that we might as well sit on our asses here at Thesmar for a solid 5 day before we set out to overtake them. They weren't going to do that, of course. It would have underscored their allies' sluggishness, which might have been taken as a deliberate insult. So, instead, they'd set out around midday tomorrow, by which time the rear of Harless's army might actually be out of sight from the heretics' entrenchments. "You're probably right, Lincoln," he said finally. "I'm sure they are doing the best they can, and the truth is, we ought to be helping them any way we can." I tried to suggest that to Duke Harless, but he chopped himself off before he suggested that Harless seemed more focused on protecting the honor of the Imperial Desnarian army by insisting it could meet its own needs than on finding the help he clearly needed. And that young snot Fearnok hadn't helped one bit. Whatever Harless might think about Desnarian honor, his grandnephew's attitude was perfectly clear, and despite his relatively junior rank, he was in a position to do plenty of damage simply by manipulating the Duke's schedule or selectively choosing which reports to draw to his attention.
"We'll just have to do the best we can," he said instead, eyes back on that enormous column as it lurched away from Thesmar. "And if the time comes that the Duke calls on us to assist Sir Boris and young Kazimar, we need to be ready to do what we can.
Remind me to discuss that with Sir Shulman this afternoon, Lincoln."
"Of course, sir."
Chapter 6. St. Boslier Canal, Tarika River, Tarika Province, Republic of Sidermark.
"Well, this is a Shanwei damned mess."
Sigmund Douglas glowered out over the racing water, then gave himself a shake and looked over his shoulder at Father Avery Pegain.
"Sorry about that, Father."
"I've heard worse, Master Douglas."
The brown-haired, brown-eyed Chihirite upper priest had extraordinarily long arms and legs for his height. He looked rather like a stork when he walked, Douglas thought, and he had a fussy clerk's way about him. That was reasonable enough for someone who belonged to the Order of the Quill, though. They were clerks and scribes, and however fussy he might be, he was sharp and efficient when it came to discharging his duties as Archbishop Arthen Zagursk's secretary.
"As a matter of fact, I've heard a lot worse over the last year or so."
Father Avery sighed.
"And for a lot less cause than this."
"It'll be a right bastard setting this right, begging your pardon, Father."
Cyrus Magruder agreed. The fair-haired canal service pilot spat into the water in obvious disgust, ice-blue eyes bleak and hard with the hatred of a man who'd spent 35 years piloting barges along the thousands of miles of canal the Holy Writ required men to maintain and preserve, not wantonly destroy.
"They knew what they were doing right enough,"
Willem Bolier put in through the teeth clenched on the stem of his pipe.
"Saw that clear enough in Faerkin, and now this."
He shook his head.
"Knew exactly where to put the charges, didn't they just?"
The silver-haired Faerkin lockmaster, who no longer had any locks to run, thanks to the same batch of heretics, had a point, Douglas reflected, studying the damage with the eye of a trained engineer. The broad, brown water-filled ditch running in front of them, its surface lashed with yellow ribbons of foam, had once been the St. Boslier Canal, a four-mile stretch of the Tarika River canal system. It had cut across a meandering 11-mile loop of the river, reducing any barge's journey by over 6 miles and simultaneously avoiding three sets of shallows, each of which would have required their own locks for anything much larger than a rowboat. Unlike most of the canals in the Temple Lands, where the walls and floor were poured concrete, or the newer canals farther south here in Sidermark, where kiln-fired brick was often used, the St. Boslier's walls were native stone, shaped by hand, squared, and laid up with mortar. Because the river level dropped almost 40 feet between the St. Boslier's upper and lower ends, it required a set of locks at each of those ends, and the heretics had blown both of them into kindling. The splintered remnants of the upper lock's stout Neroac timbers still hung from the gate frame, tracing lines of foam in the water racing through the broken lock chamber. Charges had also been set in the walls of the chamber itself, ripping them apart and spilling shattered stone and mortar into the water. And not content with that, the heretics had planted additional charges at three separate spots along the St. Boslier's length, caving in the walls at each of them. The water roaring unfettered through the canal cut had done the rest.
"It's the scour that makes most of the problem," he said.
With the gates gone and the stonework blown to Shunwei's hell, the current just ripped everything apart. And the head of the water behind the weir only made it worse. I'm half afraid we'll have to open a breach in the weir to relieve the pressure before we can get the canal properly cofferdammed.
He looked away from the ruined lock chamber at the sturdy stone weir stretching across the Tarika. Before the heretics destroyed the St. Boslier, the crest of the weir had been a smother of white and brown water pouring over the top of the 10-foot structure. Its primary function had been to raise the water level behind it, impounding what amounted to a lake almost 5 miles long to ensure sufficient water to supply the heavily used canal, especially during periods of low water. Admittedly, the outflow from East Wing Lake meant low water was a rare occurrence along this stretch, but it did happen. Even if that hadn't been true, the drop between this point and the canal's lower locks required the extra water, particularly during harvest season, when barges passed through it virtually end to end, each carrying its own charge of water down the canal. In addition, the weir supplied sluices on the south bank of the river, which had powered the water wheels of more than a dozen grist mills and manufactories. The grist mills and manufactories were charred wreckage now, courtesy of the heretics, and the water flow across the weir's crest was a shadow of what it ought to have been. Even with the spillways wide open, though, enough water had been forced through the St. Boslier to shred its walls once the stonework's integrity had been violated. Worse, it was still shredding them. The current was like a monster pry bar, levering the individual stones out of the mortar and then gouging at the ballast and earth behind them.
"Whether we break the weir or not, the first step's closing off the upper end," Douglas said, planting his hands on his hips and glowering at the river some more. "And it's going to take time, and it's going to take manpower, and we don't have enough of either of them to get it done before snowfall."
His companions looked at one another silently as someone finally said what they'd all known from the instant they set eyes on the problem. Unfortunately, their orders were to repair the canal before winter closed down operations, and those orders carried the Grand Inquisitor's own imprimatur.
"Father Taylor will be shipping us the prefabricated timbers for the lock chambers within the next 5 days or so," Douglas continued. "The chambers, both sets of chambers, have been so thoroughly washed out, though, that it'll take at least 3 or 4 5 days just to clear the wreckage, square the walls, and set footings for the timbers. We'll still have to hang the new gates, replace the windlasses and the valves, install the planking, and ballast it all right and tight. And that doesn't even consider the fact that we've got to rebuild at least 3 miles of canal wall between here and the lower locks."
He shook his head and looked at Pagan.
"I can get the materials we need, I think, Father, but I just don't have the manpower. There's never been enough local manpower to maintain the canals in Tarika and Icewind,"
Magruder said with a sigh.
"We've had to ship in work crews from the east every spring." "Not an option this year, Cyrus, I'm afraid,"
Bolier replied around his pipe, his expression grim, and Douglas nodded.
"I can bring in some labor from the border states," the engineer said, "but not enough, and not quickly enough to get this done on schedule."
He and his companions looked at one another again. None of them cared to suggest that disappointing the Grand Inquisitor would be a very bad idea.
"Is there any way you and Archbishop Arthen can help us out, Father?"
the engineer asked finally, and Pagain's face tightened.
"I'd be surprised if Tarika's present population is even 30% of what it was last fall,"
he said very carefully and precisely. "We've consolidated as many as possible of the surviving people into the bigger towns and villages, and we managed to get seed into the ground. We've been blessed by the weather this summer, and it looks as if the harvest will be good where we were able to plant, but we need the men and women in the fields to gather it. If we don't, they'll starve this winter the way so many did last winter."
"I'm afraid that's part of the problem everywhere,"
Douglas sighed. "Not to the same extent it is here, of course." His nostrils flared as he recalled the deserted farms, the empty villages, the unplanted fields and empty pastures, too often dotted with the bleached bones of livestock he'd passed on his journey from the Temple Lands.
Our labor needs are in competition with the mines and the manufactories arming the army of God, and all of it's happening just at the moment we're coming up on the farmers' busiest season. But the fact remains, without enough manpower from somewhere, there's no point even starting before spring. And if we can't get it finished before the spring floods, it'll be the end of April or even May before we get done. The silence turned harder and colder. Every one of them knew the army of the Silmans' very existence depended on repairing the damage. Winter would close the canals down by early November, whatever happened, and no one liked to think about the privations Bishop Militant Barnaby's men would endure once the snow began to fly. At the moment, long lines of dragon-drawn wagons were managing to keep the army of the Silmans supplied, but it was a near thing even in summer and early fall. When the high roads were covered in ice and snow, when the southern hill dragons had to be withdrawn to a climate they could survive, the Bishop Militant's supply line would turn into a thin, badly frayed supply thread, and it was virtually inevitable that the heretics would do everything they could to make his situation still worse.
"There might be a way," Pegain said finally. His normally warm eyes had darkened, and his expression was grim. His companions looked at him warily, and he grimaced.
"I could speak to Father Jerome," he said, his tone manifestly unhappy, and Douglas's jaw tightened. Father Jerome Clemens was a Schulerite upper priest attached to Bishop Wilbur Edwards' staff, and Edwards was the Inquisitor General for Icewind, New Northland, Mountain Cross, Hildermoss, and Westmarch. That made him the man charged with sifting those accused of heresy and apostasy and sending them to the punishment of Schuler if they were adjudged guilty. And so far, very, very few of them had been adjudged anything else. Clemens was also one of Edward's special inquisitors, responsible for ferreting out those who'd managed, so far at least, to conceal their heretical leanings. Judging by the number of secret heretics he'd hauled before the Inquisition, he was very good at his job, too. And, Douglas knew, he was also one of the Schulerites who believed a heretic should make recompense in this world before he was sent to the hellfire and torment he'd earned in the next. He'd been arguing for some time that those confined in the Inquisition's concentration camps might be profitably used as forced labor. It wasn't as if someone who'd turned his or her face against God and the archangels had any legal rights, and there'd be time enough to put them to the punishment after Mother Church had required them to help repair and rebuild all that had been destroyed in the jihad their heresy had loosed upon the world. Douglas understood the argument, but nausea rippled at the thought of employing what amounted to slave laborers already condemned to death. He had a strong suspicion the Inquisition would insist on providing overseers, and the methods they were likely to employ would be brutal and pitiless. Indeed, Clemens had scarcely even attempted to veil his belief that they might as well be worked to death, for what did it matter what happened to the bodies of those already condemned to burn in hell for all eternity? Surely there was no need to waste food or warm clothing, medical care, or weather-tight housing on those who had willfully made themselves the enemies of God himself. Sigmund Douglas was a loyal son of Mother Church. He loved God and the archangels. He revered their teachings, and he was dedicated heart and soul to the defeat of the heresy. But the thought of being part of what someone like Clemens would make of those laborers' lives was enough to sicken anyone. The Book of Schuler required they be put to the punishment. That was harsh, even cruel, but it was clearly God's command, and the Inquisition taught that its purpose was not simply to punish sin, but to attempt to reclaim the sinner even from the lip of the grave. Douglas was horrified that anyone should set his own will against God's and condemn himself to such a penalty, yet the writ was clear and unflinching. No loyal son of the church could deny that it must be done. But if that was true, then let it be done swiftly. Let Mother Church and the Inquisition show the condemned at least that much mercy. There was no need to turn the time they had left into a thing of horror. No need for men who served God to lower themselves to the level of Shan Wei and those who served her. And who's going to be the first to tell Clemens or Archbishop Willem that, Sigmund? Are you? Are you going to set your will in opposition to the Inquisitor General and the Grand Inquisitor himself? Are you going to question the measures required, however terrible they may seem, if the jihad's going to be won? And will you let your own queasiness prevent you from putting this canal back into operation when it must be put back into operation if the army of the Silmarils going to hold against the legions of hell? How many men could Father Jerome provide? He heard his own voice ask. I'm not certain, Pegain admitted. At the moment, there are somewhere around 20,000 in the camp at Tremos. That's the closest one. Douglas nodded slowly. Tremos was on the southern shore of Cat Lizard Lake, 100 miles from the St. Bosler, but the workers could be transported almost all of that distance by water. Of course, a third of those 20,000 were almost certainly children, or too young or too old to stand up to the demands of the task at any rate. But even so, we'd have to feed and house them. I'll speak to His Eminence. Pegain's expression turned even tighter, if that were possible. I'm sure he'll insist on providing the best living conditions he can for those assigned to the task. So Archbishop Arthen isn't an admirer of Father Jerome? Douglas kept his own expression as neutral as possible. I suppose that's good to know. At least it's a way to salve your conscience, isn't it, Sigmund? You can tell yourself they'll actually be better off working for you than in one of the Inquisition's camps. Shan Wei, it'll probably even be true, and isn't that a hell of a thing? All right, Father, he sighed. You'd better go ahead and inquire into the possibilities. And while you're doing that, I'll send a semaphore message back to Zion and ask Father Taylor to expedite those materials.
Chapter 7 Greentown, Trailman's Farm, and Mayum, Midhold Province, and Guarnac, Mountain Cross Province, Republic of Sidermark.
Slow down, man! Colonel Walker Tierner snapped. You're not making any sense. Or if you are, you're going so damned fast I can't tell it.
Tierner, the commanding officer of the Army of God's 16th Cavalry Regiment, wasn't a naturally choleric man, but he sounded undeniably testy at the moment, and who should blame him? Between the so-called militiaman's accent and how rapidly he was gabbling out his report, he was practically incoherent, or incomprehensible at least, and what he seemed to be saying was preposterous anyway.
They've taken Chesterville!
The militiaman drew a deep breath and forced himself to slow down, although Tierner still found his rustic Sidermarkian accent difficult.
I don't think more than a dozen men got away, and they're sending a column from Chesterville cross-country to Charlesville. They're less than 30 miles from the Mayum on the canal, too, and they're Carisian regulars. You could tell from the uniforms. It must be 40 or 50,000 of them, Colonel.
Tierner glanced across the field desk at Major Arthur Willems, his second in command. Willems looked as astonished as Tierner felt, which wasn't a great deal of help at the moment.
They don't have 40,000 men, the colonel said, turning back to the militiaman. The heretics never had more than 30,000 Carisians in the gap to begin with, and they're still in contact with our line south of Wyvern Lake.
Unless, a small voice in the back of his brain said, they've landed reinforcements at Siddar City, and our spies just haven't told me yet. But speaking of telling us yet,
why haven't we heard about this before they got so damned far along the canal? That's almost 800 miles from Wyvern Lake as the Wyvern flies, and the heretics are no freaking wyverns. Somebody should have seen them and reported them before they got that far east of the gap. How should I know?
The militiaman sounded a little testy himself, the colonel noted.
Major Briscoe got word from Colonel Tolliver at Mayum by a boat up the river and across the lake. Colonel Carsney has come in by semaphore. There's no semaphore line from Greentown to here, so the Major sent me.
Tierney grunted and raised one hand in a semi-placating gesture. He should have thought of that for himself. The fact that his brain was still trying to cope with the preposterousness of the fellow's news was no excuse, and the fact that the message was from Hamilton Briscoe suggested he ought to pay attention to it, however preposterous it sounded, he thought. Briscoe, who commanded the 1st Greentown Militia, had no formal military training, but he wasn't a fool by any stretch of the imagination. A prosperous farmer and miller before the Rising, he'd become the leader of the faithful in and around the small city of Greentown, where the Mountain Cross River flowed into Greyback Lake from the north. His militia consisted almost entirely of civilian volunteers, like the fellow in front of him, but they'd had the better part of a year to acquire discipline, and unlike some of the bands fighting in Mother Church's name, they'd done just that. And they'd shown themselves ready to do their duty, however grim, without letting that discipline break down. Lindar Talavir, commanding the Mayan militia, was one of the rare Midhold Faithful's officers who could claim pre-Rising military experience, which was the main reason he'd been given the strategically important post he held. Unlike Briscoe, he'd been a lieutenant in the Sidermarkian Regulars, and a relatively good one, as far as Tyrnir could discover. That was the good news. The bad news was that he'd been in command of his understrength regiment for less than a month. It was composed of the same sort of volunteers as the 1st Greentown, but they were more poorly armed than Briscoe's men, and Talavir had been given little time to instill the sort of discipline that provided unit cohesion. And then there was Colonel Bryson Kostner, commanding the 3rd Mountain Cross Rangers at Charlesville, and self-appointed to his present rank. Kostner and his men, like too many of the ranger companies operating against the heretics in Midhold and Mountain Cross, in Tyrnir's private opinion, were no better than brigands themselves. He couldn't fault their fervor or their faith, or even their determination to drive out heresy and apostasy with fire and the sword, but they'd spent their time swooping down on isolated farms and small villages, identifying the heretics to be burned out and seeing to the necessary burning, rather than organizing or drilling as military units. Walkyr Tyrnir would shed no tears for heretics or their get, and if the victims of excesses by Kostner's men or the other ranger companies weren't heretics, they ought to have made sure the Inquisition knew it before Kostner and his ilk came calling. For that matter, the whole Republic had been one huge nest of heresy just waiting to happen, or the Grand Inquisitor would never have launched the Sword of Schuller. It was past time the entire source of corruption was burned out once and for all, but there was nothing in the Book of Schuller about raping and pillaging, and the brutal tactics of men like Kostner contributed to the breakdown of discipline and military effectiveness. He wanted people like Kostner as far away from his own command as possible, where their possibly excessive enthusiasm for punishing the servants of Shan Wei was less likely to infect his cavalrymen. Of course, the report also raised the question of what had happened to Major Calvin Ridnour. His 5th Mountain Cross Rangers, such as they were and what there was of them, were, or had been at any rate, responsible for garrisoning what had once been Chesterville at the extreme southern end of the lake. He and Kostner were very much of a likeness. Tyrnir would miss neither of them if something nasty truly had happened to them, and it sounded as if something had in Ridnour's case, at least. Still, the Rangers knew the geography and terrain of Eastern Mountain Cross and Southern Midhold better than anyone else, so just how had these Carizians, or whoever they were, managed to surprise even Ridnour so completely? He frowned as he considered that, but what really mattered at the moment was that neither Briscoe nor Talavir was likely to send off hysterical messages without first trying to be sure they knew what they were talking about. Kostner was another matter, of course, and Briscoe was simply relaying reports from him and Talavir. That was a pity, since of all 3 faithful commanders, Briscoe was the most level-headed and possessed the best judgment. Tyrnir would have been much more willing to believe the reports if they'd come from Briscoe and one of the others had been the fellow simply passing them along. Still, what Briscoe's runner had said made sense. The main semaphore line followed the high road from Allenton to Charlesville, in the fork where the North Mountain Cross and South Mountain Cross rivers met 230 miles west of Greyback Lake. From there it went south to Brakeston, and then on to Siddar City, skirting around the lake, and Greentown was served by a secondary connection to the main line. The line south of Brakeston had been burned by the faithful in the early days of the Rising and not repaired, which had turned Charlesville into a stub at the far end of the semaphore chain and probably didn't do much for Costner's panicky sense of isolation at the moment. Tiernier's own regiment was stationed southeast of Greentown, however, covering a line between that city and Mayum, in the middle of farming country which had never been connected to the semaphore at all, which left him floating in space as far as the rapid transmission of information was concerned. Colonel Barristeer, the CO of the 73rd Cavalry Regiment and the senior officer of the screen Bishop Militant Barnaby had thrown out southeast of the Calgaran Mountains, had his headquarters almost directly on the semaphore line north of Greentown, so he was undoubtedly already in possession of Briscoe's message. It was a pity that Tolliver's boat to Greentown hadn't bothered to pass the message to Tiernier as it went past, but at least he had it now. And it was probable that Tolliver had sent a courier overland to Colonel Brenton Palmer's 53rd Cavalry, northeast of Mayum itself. It wouldn't do to make any assumptions in that regard, however.
"Find a courier," he told Major Willems, still gazing down at the map. "Send him off to the 53rd with all the information we currently have."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, that part was easy enough, Walker," the colonel told himself. "And what do you propose for your second move?"
He ran a fingertip along the line of cavalry pickets Barristeer had established as per the Bishop Militant's orders. That line was almost 300 miles long, which was a lot of ground to cover with less than 1,000 men. Their function was to locate and identify any effort by the Heretics' regular forces to move into Midhold and to assist faithful units like the 1st Greentown and Mayum Militia, and even Costner's Rangers, as needed, against the threat of heresy and Shan Wei worship. Bishop Militant Barnaby had never intended them to stop the advance of 40,000 or 50,000 Carizian regulars, but he did expect them to stop, or to at least slow down and harry any smaller, lighter forces. And he'd placed Bishop Jackson McCall's Port Harbor Division and Bishop Quentin Prescott's St. Fradier Division to Allenton to deal with anything Barristeer's cavalry couldn't. But Allenton, unfortunately, was 350 miles as a wyvern might fly northeast of Greentown, scarcely in a position to support Tiernier and his cavalrymen at the moment. He and his fellow cavalry commanders had been forced to split up their regiments into quick reaction forces. His headquarters were 40 miles northwest, more north than west, really, of Mayum, and he had two of his four companies with him. Captain Adam Jodwell, commanding his first company, had the other two 30 miles farther to his own west, so that between them they could cover the 90 miles of the screening line, which was the 16th Cavalry's responsibility. Barristeer's 73rd had the 90 miles between his own position and the Calgaran foothills, and Palmer's 53rd had the last 90 miles beyond Mayum. If he'd been Barristeer, Tiernier would have put his own regiment in the center of the line, but considering how long it had taken Briscoe's message to reach him here, perhaps Barristeer had known what he was doing when he stationed himself so close to the main semaphore line. None of which helped a great deal when it came to deciding what to do if the heretics were moving on Mayum in force, especially if they were already that close to the town. They could easily have already reached Mayum and destroyed Colonel Tolliver's garrison by the time the message reached him.
"Well, assuming there really is a column advancing towards Charlesville, it's way too far away for me to do anything about it. Costner's just going to have to be Barristeer's problem, and welcome to it. Greentown is my responsibility, according to orders, but Briscoe ought to be safe enough for now. Even if they've actually taken Mayum already, they'll have almost 200 miles of river and lake to cross before they can threaten him directly, and that assumes Tolliver didn't destroy the Mayum locks before they pushed him out of town. So, the first move is obviously to concentrate my forces and find out what has, or hasn't, actually happened at Mayum." "All right, Arthur." He looked back up at his executive officer. "When you send the message to Colonel Palmer, tell him we'll be taking 3rd and 4th companies to Mayum. I suggest he concentrate his own regiment and join us at Trailman's Farm so we can proceed together."
Trailman's Farm had once been a small, relatively prosperous farming village. These days it was a clutter of charred ruins, but it made a convenient rendezvous point 40 miles northeast of Mayum on a farm road between the town and the Greentown High Road. After that, send a messenger to Jadwell. Tell him to ring first and second companies to join us at Trailman's Farm as quickly as possible. Also send a courier to Major Briscoe with a copy of our message to Palmer and my orders to Jadwell. Instruct the major to forward both of them to Colonel Beresteyn by semaphore. Also inform him that he needs to maintain a high alert against the possibility of heretics crossing the lake in canal barges in case they really have taken Mayum and got the locks intact. At once, sir. Major Willem slapped his breastplate in salute, then turned and left the tent quickly when Tyrnir nodded to him. The colonel watched him go before he turned back to Briscoe's messenger. I suspect you know the tracks and trails around here better than I do. We'll find you a horse, and then I'd like you to guide my courier to Major Briscoe and make sure the message gets there as quickly as possible.
I can do that, the Sidermarkian replied.
Good. The colonel shook his head, looking back down at the map, trying to think of anyone else he should be sure was informed of his proposed movements. I doubt this is going to turn out to be as bad as the initial messages suggest, but I'm not going to take any chances either. We'll find out what's really going on, then do a little something about it.
Do you think they've started to scurry around yet, sir? Lieutenant Slocum asked, gazing up the river towards Greyback Lake.
Oh, I imagine they have, Baron Greenvalley replied with a thin smile. In fact, he was watching the AOG's cavalry screen scurry around at that very moment, courtesy of the Snarks, and very satisfying scurrying it was. He stood on the docks reaching out into the broad, deep-flowing Mountain Cross River above Mayum. They'd managed to take the town remarkably intact, largely because Colonel Lindar Tolliver's garrison had consisted of a single understrength regiment supported by the majority of Mayum's adult and semi-adult, unfortunately, male population. Casualties among the civilian defenders had been even heavier than among the militiamen, and there was little Green Valley's healers could do for all too many of them. The screams of wounded, barely adolescent boys and the torn, lifeless bodies of their brothers were enough to turn anyone's stomach. On the other hand, Kent Clarake had seen a lot of things fit to turn his stomach here in the Republic, and there was only one way anyone could bring those things to an end. He'd like to blame Tolliver for those broken, too young bodies, but the decision hadn't been the colonel's. The orders had come from Father Brinton Adamson, the Shulerite underpriest who'd been Mayum's schoolmaster before the rebellion. It had been his demand that had sent those boys, many of them his own students, into battle. And the one point Green Valley could see in his favor was that at least he died leading them, fighting at their head with no better weapon than a sword he'd never been trained to use. Tolliver had tried to argue with the priest, and he'd done his best to put the boys in the positions of least danger, however little good it had done in the end. He'd also realized Green Valley was coming before his men actually arrived. Not all of the Temple Loyalist commanders between Mayum and the Silmon Gap had been equally alert. Company A of the 1st Scout Sniper Regiment's 4th Battalion, mounted for the occasion on horses borrowed from the Sidermarkian Cavalry Regiment attached to Green Valley's Carizians, had seized Chesterville, at the southern terminus of the lake, from the single company of Temple Loyalist guerrillas, the so-called 5th Mountain Cross Rangers, squatting in the ruins of its burned buildings. The Rangers had outnumbered Captain Reginald Osborne's men by barely 2-1, and they'd never had a clue Osborne was coming until his men hit them. It had gone against the grain to let any of the scum who'd wreaked such havoc in Mountain Cross and Midhold escape, but the scout sniper captain had obeyed orders, and almost a dozen of the 400 Rangers had gotten away. Major Calvin Ridenour, Chesterville's commanding officer, had not been among them. Under the circumstances, and given Ridenour's practice of burning suspected heretics' houses with their owners still inside, while his men used anyone who escaped through the boarded-up windows or doors for target practice, Green Valley had already decided not to ask exactly how it was that the major had ended up with a pistol ball behind his left ear.
He did regret that Father Zephram Schiller had escaped before he could receive the same treatment, however. Schiller had lacked even the excuse of being an inquisitor, but the Langhornite underpriest had attached himself to Ridenour's command as its chaplain, and whatever he'd lacked in formal ecclesiastic authority, he'd more than made up in pure, vicious fanaticism. He'd actively encouraged Ridenour's atrocities, and Green Valley, acting upon unspecified spy reports, had formally designated him an acting inquisitor subject to imperial policy where inquisitors were concerned before sending Company A off to Chesterville. He'd really hoped Osborne would be able to enforce the policy in his case.
Well, you may catch up with him yet. For that matter, there's a better than even chance the son of a bitch will manage to drown himself for you.
The thought gave the Baron a certain satisfaction. Schiller was too terrified of the retribution he'd earned to even think about coming back ashore anywhere where the heretic hordes might get their hands on him, so he'd set out on the 94-mile voyage from Chesterville to Greentown across the longest portion of lake by himself in a rowboat. Colonel Tolliver was also dead, a fact which Green Valley came much closer to regretting. He'd been a Temple loyalist, an extremist, a mutineer, and a traitor, but he'd at least tried to keep his militia regiment under discipline and under control. It was possible he might have attempted to surrender, but he hadn't had time for that. The Mayum locks connecting the Termana Canal to the Mountain Cross River were a critical part of Green Valley's planning, and Jaspar Clinton had granted a blanket dispensation allowing the destruction of locks and canals when the Jihad's military necessity required it, despite the writ's prohibition of such actions. It still wasn't anything someone was going to undertake lightly, or when he wasn't pretty damn certain the Inquisition would agree it truly had been necessary. But thanks to the Snarks, Green Valley had known Tolliver planned to do exactly that. As a consequence, he'd ordered Brigadier Miles to take the town, and especially the waterfront area, as quickly as possible, and Colonel Prescott Tenayer's 3rd Regiment had discharged the assignment with dispatch. Tenayer's 1st and 3rd Battalions had circled around to the river east of Mayum under cover of darkness, then stormed the waterfront at the point of the bayonet. They'd lost 60 men in the attack, but their assault had been preceded by a brief, violent mortar bombardment, and they'd made liberal use of the newly improved hand grenades provided by the Delthac Works. Black powder grenades were fairly anemic, and iron casings tended to fragment into a very few large, fairly low-velocity pieces, which inflicted relatively few casualties and gave them a short radius of lethality. They'd proved a disappointment in the Khorasan campaign, but Edward Hausman's artisans had taken up the challenge, and the new grenades used cylindrical, stick-mounted tin casings instead of iron. Each of them was actually a double-walled cylinder, 2 inches wide and 4.5 inches tall, reinforced longitudinally with 3 thin, equally spaced iron strips. The flat top was closed by an iron plate attached to the reinforcing strips with screws, and the central cavity was packed with 2 pounds of pelletized gunpowder through a threaded opening in the bottom before the throwing stick was screwed into it. The 1-inch gap between the inner and outer walls was packed with lead balls, with molten sulfur poured in around them to prevent them from shifting, before the top plate was secured, and a lanyard through the hole drilled lengthwise through the stick connected to a friction primer. It was a hefty weight, but the throwing stick helped considerably, and the cloud of musket balls which punched through the tin walls when it detonated was devastating. It had also turned out to be quite effective at starting fires, although the Delthac Works promised specialized incendiary and smoke grenades sometime soon. This was the first time they'd been used in combat, and coming on the heels of the mortar bombardment, which none of Tolliver's men had ever encountered before either, they'd been even more devastating to the Temple Loyalists' morale than to their bodies. The men detailed to fire the charges intended to blow the locks had fled with their companions, and Tolliver had been killed leading a hopeless charge to retake the waterfront long enough to destroy them.
Whatever else he may have been, the man had guts, Green Valley reflected. I'm not going to shed any tears for him, but if I'd had the chance, I would have preferred to take him alive. What mattered at the moment, though, was that he had Mayim, and none of the garrison had escaped across the deep, swift-flowing river. There were a handful of fugitives dodging through the fields and forests south of the river, but none of them were on the Army of God's bank, and none had escaped upriver by boat, which meant Worsham's screening cavalry regiments were operating blind.
"Find Major Dyersail, Bryon,"
he said, still gazing up the river towards the lake.
"Tell him I want his scout snipers to get across on the ferry and push out a couple of miles towards the Greentown High Road. Warn him to keep a special eye on the road to Trailman's Farm, too. I'm sure he would anyway, but if there are any Temple boys in the vicinity, that's where they're most likely to be, I think. And if I were Worsham, they'd be cavalry, not infantry. Tell Dyersail I want observers and couriers who can get back to the river before any Temple boy cavalry comes calling. Hopefully without being spotted themselves. Then ask Colonel Tenaya if I can borrow Major Naismith."
"Heretic regulars? At Chesterville and Mayim? That's ridiculous!"
Bishop Militant Barnaby Worsham glared at the brown-haired young lieutenant who had had the misfortune to bring him the semaphore dispatch. Lieutenant Gordon Fainston was the Bishop Militant's junior aide, an efficient young man who normally enjoyed his superior's favor. At the moment, that favor seemed somewhat less pronounced than usual. Wisely, the young man said nothing, and after a moment, Worsham's glare abated. He dropped the dispatch on his desk and sat back in his chair, transferring his gaze from Fainston to Colonel Clarendon Maxwell, his senior aide. Maxwell, who would have been called chief of staff in the Carisian army, looked back at him rather more calmly than he actually felt.
"How in Chihiro's name could they possibly have Carisian regulars that far east of the gap?"
Worsham demanded in what both aides recognized was a rhetorical question.
"Did they manage to pull them away from our front without anyone even noticing?"
That was a rather less rhetorical inquiry. Indeed, it was a distinctly pointed one, and Maxwell grimaced.
"I don't think so, my lord, but it's possible they might have pulled at least some strength away."
The colonel's expression was as unhappy as his tone.
"I hate to say it, but the truth is that those damned scout snipers of theirs are better than any light infantry we've got, even with local guides. Trying to get our patrols around their flanks to see what's going on behind their front is a losing proposition. We're still trying, but we're taking a lot of casualties for very little return.
And the upshot is that we really don't know what they may be doing in their rear areas,"
Worsham said sourly.
"Essentially, yes," Maxwell admitted. "The reports we're seeing are the best ones anyone can give us, my lord. I'd be less than honest if I suggested that they were anything remotely like definitive and complete."
"Wonderful." Worsham closed his eyes, raised his hand, and pinched the bridge of his nose. He was confident Alain Maguire understood the situation on his front and why he was stuck here, holding the cork in the Silmon Gap against the heretics just as they'd held the cork at Cerebor against him, despite his numerical advantage. From conversations with Auxiliary Bishop Ernest Abernethy, the army of the Silmon's special intendant, he was rather less confident Jaspar Clinton shared Vicar Alain's views. Frankly, the Bishop Militant was astounded Clinton had been willing to even consider, far less agree to, Vicar Elaine's decision to pull his pikemen back to the border states on the far side of his sundered supply lines. There were less of them than there had been. Worsham had been turning them into riflemen as rapidly as he could, given the relatively low number of new rifles which had managed to make their way to the front, but there'd still been over 30,000. That made 30,000 less mouths for him to feed, which would be a godsend over the winter, but it also left him with little more than 65,000 men, a quarter of them cavalry. Once fighting spread beyond the Silmon Gap, he was going to be far too thin on the ground to pursue the sorts of adventures Clinton wanted him to undertake, and that could prove unfortunate. Worsham got along well with his own special intendant on a personal level. He liked Bishop Ernest, and he knew he was fortunate to have the young Schulerite, instead of one of the narrow-minded, intolerant zealots like Conor Catesworth's Cedric Xavier, or even some of the other inquisitors assigned to the army of the Silmon's regiments.
Nonetheless, Abernethy had no choice but to pass along the reports from the Grand Inquisitor and deliver the directed homilies to the troops every Wednesday, and their tone suggested Clinton's patience was limited, to say the least.
"And he won't take kindly to any suggestion that the heretics are even thinking about retaking southern Midhold and eastern Mountain Cross, either. That's the farthest east the Rising succeeded. Allenton's less than 300 miles from the coast. Shan Wei, it's less than 900 miles from Siddar City. He won't take kindly to coughing up the crown jewel of his Sword of Shula, whatever the reason. That means he's going to insist I do something to prevent it, when I don't even know where the heretics found the men to make the effort."
The bishop militant suppressed a temptation to use language which would have been far more suitable for simple Colonel Worsham of the Temple Guard, because if Clinton did insist on that, he was very probably going to be right, or much closer to it than usual, if only for all the wrong reasons. He lowered his hand and opened his eyes again, looking at the huge map on his office wall. A large red pushpin represented his own headquarters at Guarnac, which remained the Army of the Silmons' primary supply head, despite the heretics' canal raid. Other, smaller pins represented other forces, including the one at Allenton in Midhold, representing Bishop Quentin Prescott and Bishop Jackson McCall. Their 4,000 men were there ostensibly to support the faithful throughout Midhold, but their true purpose, as Vicar Elaine at least understood perfectly well, was to protect the Northland Gap. It was unlikely the heretics could drive him out of his present position with frontal attacks up the Silmon Gap. His defenses were too strong for that. Even if they'd been willing to take the casualties, any assault could only have failed, so they had to be considering other approaches to removing him. There weren't a lot of those other approaches available, however. And there'd be even fewer once they evacuated their enclave at Salik on Spinefish Bay. That had to happen in the next month or so, certainly by early November, because of the ice, and while they might land troops at Ronshare to come at his rear that way instead, he rather thought it was too late in the year for that as well. Ronshare Bay usually froze as well, and the heretics wouldn't want to put a significant force into the field when winter might be all it took to cut its supply lines. Worsham's lips twitched with bitter amusement at that thought. He'd had more experience of his own with cut supply lines than he'd ever wanted. But with Salik and Ronshare struck from the list, that left an overland attack through Midhold, Northland, and the Northland Gap as the most likely threat. There were ports and fishing villages along the Midhold coast where supplies could be landed even in winter if they had to be. Not that it was likely such measures would be necessary. The road and canal net to Greyback Lake and then to Allenton was well developed and seldom seriously hampered by winter weather. Yet while he'd been aware of the possible threat for quite some time, Worsham hadn't considered it an immediate probability simply because he'd known the only available Carisian forces were still bogged down in the Silmon Gap, 1,300 miles from the Northland Gap. But if there truly were Carisians at Chesterton, they were already more than halfway there, and less than 500 straight-line miles from Allenton. All of which suddenly made that 4,000-man garrison look a lot less secure than it had appeared 5 minutes ago.